You might even see a boiler there. Obviously, the boiler is not as we have today. But for example, a fire, coal being thrown into this fire. And that fire then obviously creating the warmth that is inside that particular place. So a person who is able then to pay attention to exactly all these things that are going around him and to remember the fire, you know, it's something that will enable him that when he leaves, he is conscious that he needs to pay attention to his deeds, pay attention to his actions, pay attention to his responsibilities, and so on and so forth. And the second thing the Imam says, and bodily dirt is removed. So then, for example, a person also gets clean. And we know that cleanliness is part of godliness, the famous tradition of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. So here, for example, it is seen that the house itself has, you know, no benefit. My own understanding is that, for example, that house or that bathhouse at that time had no benefit. But if a person pays attention to those things around it that enables him to remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and it's also both of these things do, then it becomes the best of houses. Remembering the grave is one of the best of actions. Remembering one's ultimate abode obviously enables a person to pay attention to everything else that he does. Knowing that one day he will be going there, he will obviously work towards that final abode. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to take lessons from the world around us. This is what this hadith teaches us, that to take lessons from the world around us and to obviously pay attention to our ultimate abode and to work towards it, that we have a good ultimate abode, inshaAllah. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
Debate.
Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have held their first joint military drills since the year 2014. They held the drill to unveil their military capabilities and equipment. Now, the immediate question that arises is, why are they holding the drills at this time? Is there something in the works, or is it simply a show of force, resistance, and preparation against their enemy, Israel? In this edition of the debate, we will zoom in on these two questions and find out from our guests where the situation may end up.
In an incident considered the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip, the joint chamber of the Palestinian resistance factions held its first larger-scale joint military drill over the past years. During the one-day military exercise, Palestinian groups unveiled some of their military capabilities and equipment.
The Palestinian resistance groups showed their unity in this joint military exercise. The drill is aimed at showing the improvement of the resistance capabilities. It sends this message to the Israeli enemy that we are capable of facing any aggression against the Gaza Strip.
The drill consisted of simulation of ground and air military operations, during which several rockets were fired toward the sea.
We believe that the unity of all Palestinian groups is the only way to improve our strength and capabilities in order to face the Israeli regime. It shows how strong we have become in our struggle against the occupation.
Today, the resistance groups sent a strong message to the Israeli army that the Palestinian resistance is capable of defending Palestinians against any aggression. It also showed how united they are in their resistance.
Since 2008, Israel has waged three wars against Gaza, where 2 million Palestinians live under a 12-year Israeli blockade from air, sea and land. Thousands of Gazans have been killed in each of these deadly wars.
The Palestinian resistance groups say they hold the drills to show their military capabilities as well as unity in fight against the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Moti Abu Musabeh, who's a Palestinian political activist, joining us from Gaza City. And we also have Khalid Barakat, who's a journalist and activist, joining us from Vancouver. I'd like to welcome you both. Moti Abu Musabeh, let me first start with you and ask you a straightforward question. Why the Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip are holding their first joint military drill, something that hasn't happened since the year 2014, the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me here once again. And actually, if we want to talk about this military drill implemented by the Palestinian military factions here in the Gaza Strip, I think we need to focus and shed the light on the messages that the Palestinian factions wanted to send to different parties, actually, at the same time. And I think the first one and the most important message was directed to the Israeli occupation and the Israeli leaders, especially in these political conditions and the political deadlocks that those leaders are experiencing on the Israeli arena. We all realize and we all know that the Israeli leaders used to maneuver and evade their internal political deadlocks and the crisis by attacking the Palestinian territories in order to export those political deadlocks and the crisis. So the clear message for the Israeli leaders was that the Palestinian resistance factions are well prepared to confront and to resist any Israeli aggression and offense against the population of the Gaza Strip. And the clear message also was that the Palestinian resistance would never allow for the Israeli leaders to invest and to exploit and to use the Palestinian blood as a winning card to achieve their political aims at the expense of the Palestinian people. So I think that the message was clear to the Israeli occupation that the situation here is nowadays is different. And any decision and making such a decision of attacking Gaza is different from any other precedented decisions today. And any attack and any offense against Gaza Strip would never be a picnic for the Israeli soldiers. This, I think, was the first one. Secondly, I think that the Palestinian resistance factions through this military drill reminded the whole world and the international community that it is still turning a blind eye to the Israeli ongoing perpetual crimes against the Palestinian people. Okay. That the Palestinians have the mere right to defend themselves against that Israeli crime.
Right. Okay. Very well. Let's move on to Khalid Barakat. Khalid Barakat. So, our guest was zooming in amongst many points that he made about the reaction that Israel is going to have on this. We're looking at 12 Palestinian armed groups that actually held these drills, firing rockets into the Mediterranean, launching drones in the airspace. We saw rockets being fired, and of course the footage there is testament to the depth of what was executed. Do you think that, well, what message will that send to Israel in your opinion, and do you think that that would change Israel's calculations when they and if they want to attack Gaza, as they have done so many times, including obviously the three major wars?
Yes, I think that the message is that the Palestinian resistance is sending to Israel and other parties as well is that the internal Palestinian front in Gaza is united, and the Palestinian resistance factions and forces are united in confronting any Israeli aggression. Let's remember that these Palestinian military drills and exercises comes at the anniversary of the massacre that took place in 2008 when Israel launched a full-scale aggression against people in Gaza in 2008, what they called CASLED, and it resulted in killing more than 1,400 Palestinians, the destruction of thousands of houses, killing more than 430 Palestinian children, even the destruction of some of UN facilities, hospitals, mosques, and so on and so forth. So this message to Israel is that we, Palestinian resistance, are ready and alert, and they will respond against any Israeli aggression. Let's remember that also in that time, Obama was getting ready to be in the White House, very similar situation to what we see today with Biden, and Israel used deception at that time in order to launch a sudden attack against people in Gaza. The first day of that aggression resulted in the killing of more than 200 Palestinians. And so the resistance wants to send a message that we are alert, we are united, and at the same time, it is a message to the normalization camp and the defeated camp in the region that Gaza, despite the siege that it's been placed under for more than 12 years now, the capabilities of the Palestinian resistance is not, you know, you cannot compare it to 2008. Today, they're united, they're strong, and the not just the Palestinian resistance, but resisting camp in the region as well are united and alert.
Okay, so Moti, let's look at another outcome out of this one-day drill that has come out, and that is that obviously, aside from the unity that is shown amongst these Palestinian factions, we're also looking at they have said that perhaps this lack of Palestinian reconciliation and the normalization of relations with Israel by some Arab countries is another message that this sends out. Do you agree with that?
Yes, actually, beside what your guest has mentioned, and beside what was mentioned by throughout the report, I think the message was clear that despite, especially in these hard circumstances and this hard time that the Palestinians and the Palestinian cause is experiencing, and actually we all are witnessing the cruel attempts of the surrounding Arab regimes to liquidate the Palestinian cause and end the Palestinians' rights nowadays. So I think the timing of this drill is key and important, that despite all those shameful and disgraceful agreements that aims to liquidate the Palestinian cause in favor of the Israeli occupation, in return for some investments here or there, and actually the message was clear, that despite all of that, Palestinians would never allow to relinquish their rights to drop their weapons or to raise the white flag. Yes, those normalization agreements constituted a stab in the back of the Palestinian people and abandoned the Palestinian people alone in front of the criminal Israeli occupation. But the Palestinians, despite all of that, would never drop their weapon and would never surrender for the Israeli occupation. I think this this is a clear message in this time exactly. The second message is, was that despite the failure of the conciliation negotiation between the Palestinian faction, the real unity translated on the ground and expressed by the was expressed by the such a military drill, which constituted a clear has delivered a clear message that the real unity is in the field and the Palestinians military, and there is a wide consensus among the Palestinians that the resistance choice is the mere choice for them to regain their rights and to to have their rights again, okay. Of living in dignity and freedom.
Okay, Khaled Barakat, this comes at a time when recently, a day or two ago, we had the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah, Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, that said that Israel had threatened to hit one of its facilities, and the Secretary General said that, if you do that, we have, first of all, twice as many precision-guided missiles as a year ago, and we have the capability with these missiles to hit all of Palestine and all of Israel, the occupied territories. Then you have the Palestinian factions that executed this one-day military exercise, which is very large-scale and one of its kind. So we can see that the resistance front is very strong. Is there a connection here? And also, again, if I was Israel and I'm looking at these events, I would think twice about any military adventurism that perhaps they might want to do or go ahead with.
Absolutely. And we see that the unity of the resistance camp in the region is more strong today than any other time in the last 10 years. The coordination and the level of cooperation between the resistance in Lebanon and the Palestinian resistance, with the support of Iran and Syria, and the popular support, the wide popular support that the resistance enjoy. We see that the Palestinian people across the board, whether in Palestine or in exile and diaspora, looks at the Palestinian resistance and the Lebanese resistance as a one front. And we also see the vast popular support that these exercises are getting. Now, the challenge really is the political challenge, the internal political challenges, whether in Lebanon or in Palestine, and more importantly, the political front. We see that the weak link in Palestine is the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. This is a force, a reactionary force that is now trying to send messages to the Biden administration that they're ready to go back to negotiations and security cooperation with Israel. Today in Palestine, we see these two camps very clearly, the camp of resistance and the camp of, the Palestinian Authority and security cooperation. So in Lebanon, the interview, the comprehensive interview that General Secretary of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, gave the interview of the year, he pointed out that the capabilities of the resistance in Lebanon in the last since 2006 battle until to today, we see that how the capabilities is absolutely mounted and is more strong than before. Also, in a few days, it will be the anniversary of the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, and the crime that the United States have committed against Iran and Iraq by assassinating a general who played central role in supporting both the Lebanese and the Palestinian resistance. So it is, in a way, a message to the enemy, but at the same time, it is a message of solidarity and unity.
Okay, since you've touched on that there, Khaled Barakat, I'm going to ask our guest there from Gaza City. You know, we are looking at this one-year anniversary, and Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was very symbolic for the Palestinians who looked at his martyrdom and the way that he was assassinated very deeply, that he was somebody who sacrificed his life for Palestine, for Jerusalem al-Quds, and obviously supported the Palestinian resistance. We're looking again at this, the focus of our debate, which is this one-day military exercise, and there's lots of notions that there's going to be retaliation that may occur as a result. Do you think, therefore, that there is a connection here, that this anniversary is coming up, and you have this one-day military exercise that happened in the Gaza Strip? Mut Abu Masada.
Yes, Yes. Actually, there is a strong connection between these two topics. There is a clear message that the Palestinians realize the role that Qasem Soleimani has played in supporting the Palestinian resistance here in the Gaza Strip. And we cannot neglect or ignore such a role that the martyr Qasem Soleimani has played in supporting the Palestinian resistance. The clear message, I think that despite all the cruel attempts and despite all the attacks and all the clampdown against the resistance pivot here in the region, that the resistance the resistance fronts, either it was in Palestine, in Gaza, or in Lebanon, or in any other place, is still strong against the Israeli occupation and the United States.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. We're going to end it there. Let me thank our guests. You were just listening to Moti Abu Musaba, Palestinian political activist there from Gaza City, and Khaled Barakat, a pleasure to have you, journalists and activists from Vancouver. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tagway, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program Ulama Speech. In today's program, we will listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
امام عسکری علیه السلام از مهمترین کارهاش برای اینکه مردم آماده غیبت بشن شبکه وکالت تربیت.
From among the most important actions of Imam Hassan al-Askari for the people's preparation for the occultation was to strengthen the network of representatives, telling the people you should be connected to them with one who deeply knows the religion, has taqwa, that is piety, is adil, meaning he is just, be connected with them. So that in the time of the ghaiba, the occultation, if you aren't able to contact us directly, if you aren't able to connect with us, don't lose your religion due to not having a connection with the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Today, at times, somebody asks, who is your marja'i taqlid? Response, oh sir, marju taqlid, all these that are in Qom. What do you mean by all these that are in Qom? Who is your marju taqlid? It must be specific. You should know. You refer to a specialist when you get a cold. Why not in the matters of religion? They, the maraji, are the specialists. A jurisprudent with deep knowledge of the religion, with taqwa, that is piety, and he is adil, meaning he is just. A person must refer to them in their personal issues. As per social issues, refer to that which is known as wilayatul faqih. Our imams did not just leave us alone. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is the first ever Iranian-made coronavirus vaccine that has made its way to human trials. It's called Coviran. Produced by Iranian biotech firm Shifa Farm, the vaccine was tested on 3 volunteers during a ceremony attended by Iran's health officials.
Today is a very promising day for all Iranians. Today we reap the strenuous efforts of our experts and researchers who work tirelessly to produce this vaccine. We are already setting up the needed infrastructure for the mass production of this vaccine to kick off its production at a large scale as soon as it clears all of the human trials.
Some 60,000 people signed up to get the jab after a call for volunteers issued by the health ministry. Out of this number, 56 people were confirmed for the first stage of the human trials. The approved volunteers will receive 2 shots within 2 weeks. The results will be announced roughly a month after the second shot. The first person who received the vaccine was the daughter of this man, who was in charge of the project to develop a local vaccine. He says this was meant to prove to all Iranians that the local vaccine is safe.
I want to send this message that I care about the health of my people the same way as I care about my children. The second message is that I, as a leader of this project, I'm 100% certain about the effectiveness and the safety of this vaccine.
Iran is working on 7 other local vaccines, each using a different technology for immunization against the virus. but none has so far cleared animal trials. Coviran uses a coronavirus that is weakened or killed by chemicals, similar to how polio immunizations work. Leading Western vaccines like Pfizer use newer, less proven technologies to target the coronavirus's spike protein using RNA. Iranian experts say their vaccine has an edge over its rivals. Coviran does not need to be kept in ultra-low temperatures, an issue that Pfizer is grappling with.
This vaccine, they don't need any special refrigerator. In a normal refrigerator, we can do it. And you know that our primary health care in Iran is very, very good. And maybe a lot of other countries, they don't have a primary health care. In primary health care, we are able to vaccinate very soon most of the people.
Coviran will be tested on at least 10,000 volunteers before getting the approval of the health ministry to hit the market. Health officials expect that the process will take a few months. Until then, Iranian authorities need to import foreign-made vaccines to inoculate their citizens. But U.S. sanctions are a barrier. The embargoes do not directly target Iran's medical industry. But due to banking restrictions, the country cannot transfer money to any international medical firm which would sell its products to Iran.
Experts here say their concerns about the sanctions have acted as a catalyst that helped catapult them to the human trial phase ahead of the set deadline. Now as the Iranian vaccine is inching closer to the market, hopes are revived that Iranians will no longer have to worry about the American barriers that block their access to foreign vaccines. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
These days, Lebanon is hosting various events marking the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. This book reads, "The Man Who Vanquished America," will be out in bookstores on the martyrdom anniversary on January 3rd. The author tells Press TV he started writing after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, and the main inspiration for him was the personality of the man who changed the region and even the world.
This man is the man, in terms of strategy, is the man of the century. The United States could not beat him. On the contrary, he defeated the United States in many posts, in many positions, in many places, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine. So he outsmarted them.
One of the main discernments of deep study of the assassination of General Soleimani was that the will of the resistance will be more adamant on removing the U.S. hegemonic presence from the region.
Achieved nothing. They killed the freedom in their mind when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. They killed justice in their mind and in their people when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. On the contrary, Haj Qasem Soleimani now is living in every person or a thinker who think that Haj Qasem Soleimani represents such slogans, freedom, justice, and liberty.
U.S. Army generals and strategists, as well as those who grieved him, agree that the commander of the Quds Force brought the people of West Asia together and made the cause of fighting U.S. oppression a united struggle. Other virtual events to commemorate the memory of the Iranian commander were held by a group of activists in the form of Lebanese traditional storytelling. Through this art form, the writers tried to narrate to the people of Lebanon the story of Commander Qasem Soleimani and his significant role in thwarting U.S. plots.
The biggest shock was when the U.S. Army General Petraeus read a message which read, "I am Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Al-Quds forces. I am the one who conducts the Iranian policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the entire region. And the Iranian ambassador in Iran is a member of the Quds force."
Many in the region who knew General Qasem Soleimani or learned about him after his martyrdom say they have no doubt that his martyrdom and the deeds done during his lifetime will lead to a complete liberation of the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines across Europe began this weekend.
Healthcare workers and the elderly are getting the jab first. EU leaders have negotiated contracts for more than 2 billion vaccine doses from various suppliers. The first 200 million are the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine.
It was important for me to get vaccinated in order to protect myself, to protect my family and to be a part of the solution to stop the pandemic.
I felt honored to get the vaccine and lucky because I can finally feel more protected. What gives me relief is the prospect that after such a difficult and challenging period, we will finally get to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
The EU had planned the rollout to begin in unison across the bloc Sunday, but Hungary, Germany and Slovakia couldn't wait and began vaccinating on Saturday. The Netherlands says it won't start vaccinating until January 8th. The start of the EU's vaccine rollout comes after a more infectious COVID-19 variant was detected in the UK, which led to dozens of countries closing their borders to UK citizens.
Only if countries are looking and testing effectively, will you be able to pick up variants and adjust strategies to cope. We must ensure that countries are not punished for transparently sharing new scientific findings.
The new variant has been detected in several EU countries as well, but vaccine developers say they expect their shots to work against COVID-19 mutations. More than 600,000 vulnerable people have already been vaccinated in the UK, which started administering the Pfizer jab 2.5 weeks ago. But ministers warn the country must double its vaccination target to 2 million a week in order to avoid a third wave.
I think it's an incredibly serious, incredibly dangerous moment. I think all of us always felt that January was going to become very hard and that we were heading into a very hard winter, and hospital leave was being cancelled and ITUs were being got ready. And yet, nevertheless, I feel like we weren't ready for something quite as severe as this feels, with the sheer level of caseload and the added effect of the variant virus building up our R number and making things so much harder than we expected.
The UK hopes to expand its vaccination programme with the rollout of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, which is expected on January 4th. There are now more COVID-19 patients in hospitals in England than there were during the peak of the first wave, and more than 71,000 Britons have died of the virus. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Israeli regime has been intensifying its moves in the region as media revelations suggest it is intending to build a military base on the Yemeni island of Socotra. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned these suspicious moves, promising Israel a decisive response in case it commits any stupidity against the Yemenis.
The Israeli move is not new, as it is running the region through some puppet regimes. The Yemeni position is clear as it was 6 years ago. We are in the midst of a war launched by Saudi Arabia with the tacit backing of American and Zionist regimes.
The Israeli media have boasted the arrival of the submarine to the Bab al-Mandab Strait after crossing the Suez Canal. An Israeli military spokesman also confirmed the move, claiming the step was taken to counter smart drones Iran could potentially launch from Yemen or Iraq.
The presence of Israeli entities in the Yemeni territorial waters dates back to the beginning of the Saudi-led aggression. It was just a year ago. There were plenty of statements by some Arab rulers pledging to stop what they claimed the Iranian expansion in the region. However, the same rulers are silent on the Israeli agenda. They have not only normalized their ties with the regime, but allow its submarines pass through the Red Sea.
It seems that the Yemeni army's possession of missile systems capable of reaching as far as Eilat has become a nightmare for Israel and its cronies. Tel Aviv knows that it will not be immune to the Yemeni retaliation. However, sending one of its submarines is yet another provocative move by Israel to set the region on fire.
Israel is still using Iran as a pretext for its interventions in the region, that despite the exposure of its agenda, especially in Yemen, which is suffering from a war led by Saudi Arabia, but was actually jointly hatched by some Arab regimes and their backers in Washington and Tel Aviv. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani 1 year after his assassination by U.S. forces in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani played a major role in strengthening Palestinian resistance movements against the Israeli regime.
We commemorate the first anniversary of the martyrdom of the great commander Haj Qasem Soleimani, who died for the sake of Jerusalem al-Quds. This anniversary comes amid great pressures on the resistance in the region. On this occasion, we vow to follow in the footsteps of the commander to liberate Palestine.
Following the assassination of General Soleimani, Palestinians held several events to pay tribute to the late Iranian commander. They consider him as a hero for Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
On the anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we express our great gratitude for sacrifices he made for the sake of oppressed Palestinians.
The assassination of General Soleimani on Donald Trump's orders has sent shockwaves across the West Asia. Soleimani's memory continues to live in the hearts and minds of Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip.
Palestinians will continue to remain steadfast and condemn the treason by some Arab countries that have normalized ties with the Zionist regime. On this occasion, Palestinians also vow to fight the occupation until regaining their freedom.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike on January 3rd. Palestinians say martyr Qasem Soleimani has sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds and has always supported Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of the former commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, General Qasem Soleimani, people are now holding commemoration ceremonies to pay respect to this late Iranian icon. We went to the city of Qom, where a movement called Resistance Youth Front is formed to support the cause of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who defeated the ominous phenomenon of Daesh. Scholars, youth, activists, and resistance movement supporters from countries like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India attended the ceremony to tell the world that General Soleimani's cause will not be forgotten.
It's a great pleasure for all of us, for all the people of the world who are free, who just think freely, okay? So such kind of attribution actually led us to not only memorize or recall their memory, actually also to follow their path. That is the path of humanity. That is the real war on terror, war against terror.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, they fight for saving the life of all mankind, of all Muslim and non-Muslim.
General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by a U.S. strike on January 3rd last year when he was on an official visit to the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Hitting his convoy, the assault also led to the death of many others, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or Hashd al-Shaabi. Apart from this ceremony held here, within the coming days, a number of other events will be held across Iran under health protocols to pay tribute to General Qasem Soleimani. Human Abedi, Qom.
Afghans are a nation with a long history of resistance against various enemies. Since 19th century, Afghanistan has been invaded by different armies. The Colonial Army of Britain, the Red Army of the Soviet Union, and the Black Army of Terrorism, along with its international backers. They all tried to break the will of Afghans. As experts say, the existence of a resistance spirit among Afghans has helped them to make contacts with other resistance figures beyond the Afghan borders. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was one such figure who was interested in having ties with anti-terrorism and anti-hegemony resistance movements, mainly across the Middle East and some other Asian countries, including Afghanistan.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was popular in many societies like Afghanistan.
He was a charismatic leader who fought terrorism and helped many oppressed nations to strongly stand against terrorism.
Many others also believe that the charismatic personality of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani revives for Afghans the memory of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. It becomes more interesting when you understand that both Soleimani and Massoud had friendly ties before Massoud's assassination, only 2 days ahead of the 9/11 attacks.
Lieutenant General Soleimani had a transnational personality. He had close ties and cooperation with our national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud and Professor Rabbani, who were leading anti-terrorism resistance in northern Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that many here in Afghanistan believe the slaying of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was leading regional resistance against terrorists, is not an endpoint in the fight against terror. Rather, his assassination has made the resistance front all the more determined in its campaign against terrorists. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria, an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first 5 volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included 3 elderly patients with underlying health conditions and 2 healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the 2 doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against a pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in 3 phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers. And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its 3rd hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a 3rd corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe.
Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
On International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the Israeli blockade. Coronavirus infections have skyrocketed in the Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment. Human rights organizations say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
The Israeli blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, and especially on the health sector. The health sector is suffering from an unprecedented deterioration due to lack of medicines and medical supplies, as well as trained medical personnel to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver.
Our people are suffering because of the Zionist blockade under the watchful eye of the international community. The situation has only gotten worse amid the coronavirus pandemic.
As infections continue to rise, experts are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the coronavirus.
The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is catastrophic and is getting worse by the day. The health sector is unable to provide proper medical care to coronavirus patients and even struggles to provide tests for the deadly virus. Gaza has a population of over 2 million and hospitals don't have enough beds for the patients.
The COVID-19 pandemic remains a serious concern due to the capacity gaps in the enclave's health system. Hospitals in the tiny enclave lack medical facilities and medicines to tackle the deadly virus due to years of Israeli blockade. Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health sector since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Limelight. North Korea says the only way it will give up its nuclear weapons is if the U.S. abandons its hostile policy. In other words, takes reciprocal steps toward arms reduction. But so far, Washington has made no moves nor indicated any intention of moving toward that goal, says Hyun Lee Ryder in an article published under the heading U.S. Must Commit to Arms Reduction if it wants North Korea to do so. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. For decades, U.S. policymakers have asked, how do we get North Korea to give up nuclear weapons, and have come up empty-handed. As the Biden administration prepares to take office, perhaps it's time to ask a different question. How do Americans get to peace with North Korea? Here's the dilemma facing Washington. On the one hand, the U.S. doesn't want to allow North Korea to have nuclear weapons because that may encourage other countries to do the same. The U.S. has tried to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons through pressure and sanctions, but that approach has backfired, hardening Pyongyang's resolve to hone its nuclear and missile technology. North Korea says the only way it will give up its nuclear weapons is if the U.S. abandons its hostile policy, in other words, takes reciprocal steps toward arms reduction. But so far, Washington has made no moves, nor indicated any intention of moving toward that goal. In fact, the Trump administration continued to conduct joint war drills with South Korea and tightened enforcement of sanctions against North Korea, despite its commitment in Singapore to make peace with Pyongyang. Enter Joe Biden. How will his team resolve this dilemma? Repeating the same failed approach and expecting a different result would be, well, you know, how the saying goes. Biden's advisors are in consensus that the Trump administration's all-or-nothing approach, demanding up front that North Korea give up all its weapons, has failed. Instead, they recommend an arms control approach, first freezing North Korea's plutonium and uranium nuclear operations, and then taking incremental steps toward the ultimate goal of complete denuclearization. This is the preferred approach of Secretary of State nominee Antony Blinken, who advocates an interim deal to cap North Korea's nuclear weapons
to buy time to work out a long-term agreement. He says we should get allies and China on board to pressure North Korea. Squeeze North Korea to get it to the negotiating table. We need to cut off its various avenues and access to resources, he says. And advocates telling countries with North Korean guest workers to send them home. If China won't cooperate, Blinken suggests that the U.S. threaten it with more forward-deployed missile defense and military exercises. Blinken's proposal is barely different from the failed approach of the past. It's still a policy of pressure and isolation to get to the ultimate goal of unilaterally disarming North Korea. The only difference being that the Biden administration is willing to take more time getting there. In this case, North Korea will likely continue to press forward on its nuclear weapons and missile capability. Unless the U.S. drastically shifts its position, renewed tension between the U.S. and North Korea is inevitable. Instead of focusing on how to get North Korea to give up its nukes, asking how to reach permanent peace in Korea may lead to a different and more fundamental set of answers. All parties, not just North Korea, have a responsibility to take steps toward mutual arms reduction. After all, the U.S. still has 28,000 troops in South Korea, and until recently, regularly conducted massive war exercises that included plans for preemptive strikes on North Korea. Past joint war drills have included flying B-2 bombers, which are designed to drop nuclear bombs and cost U.S. taxpayers approximately $130,000 an hour to fly. Although the U.S. and South Korea have scaled back their exercises since the Trump-Kim summit in 2018, the commander of U.S. Forces, Korea General Robert B. Abrams, has called for the resumption of the large-scale joint war drills. If the Biden administration moves ahead with the war drills next March, it would renew dangerous military tension on the Korean Peninsula and harm any chance for diplomatic engagement with North Korea in the near future. To reduce the threat of nuclear war with North Korea and preserve the option of resuming talks in the future, the Biden administration can do two things in its first 100 days. One, continue to the suspension of large-scale U.S.-South Korean joint war drills. And two, start a strategic review of its North Korea policy that begins with the question, how do we get to permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula? An essential part of establishing permanent peace is ending the Korean War, which has remained unresolved for 7 years, and replacing the armistice or temporary ceasefire with a permanent peace agreement. This is what the two Korean leaders agreed to do in their historic Panmunjom summit in 2018. And the idea has the support of 52 members of the U.S. Congress, who co-sponsored House Resolution 152, calling for a formal end of the Korean War. 7 years of unresolved war has not only fueled a perpetual arms race among the parties to the conflict, it has also created an impenetrable border between the two Koreas that has kept millions of families apart. A peace agreement that commits all parties to a gradual process of laying down their arms would create peaceful conditions for the two Koreas to resume cooperation and reunite separated families. Many people in the U.S. think North Korea doesn't want peace, but looking back at its past statements reveals otherwise. For example, following the Korean War, which had ended in an armistice in 1953, North Korea was part of the Geneva Conference, convened by the four powers, including the United States, the former USSR, the United Kingdom, and France, to discuss the future of Korea. According to a declassified report by the U.S. delegation, then North Korea